David.
Hi, Debbie.
Hello, stranger. How are you?
Good. It's been too long. How have you been?
I have been fine. How have you been? How are the cats?
Everybody's great. Yeah, we're all good. I just got back to the States a couple days ago, and so just kind of getting reacquainted with everybody. But everybody's good.
But I got to tell you, Dave, you have outdone yourself with House of Ninjas. Outdone yourself.
Thank you so much.
Now, you know, one of the greatest joys of the past 18 years that we've known each other has been watching your growth as a director. And when you had that one slight falter and then came back guns blazing with Man from Reno, and you were right back on track, even better than before. It has been a joy to watch you grow and develop. But what you do here with ninjas, you knock it out of the damn park. Just amazing.
Oh, thank you. That's so nice of you to say that. So, coming from somebody who knows one of the few people who know all of my work, all the way going back, that really means a lot.
Well, yeah. Thanks. It amazes people when it's like, no, yes, I know Dave quite well. We go all the way back to Big Dreams, Little Tokyo. Well, what was that?
Yeah.
I said, people. Yeah. This, I binge watched the whole series.
Oh, cool. Great. That's great to hear. I always love it when people tell me that, because we wanted it to be something that you just want to see what happens next. So. That's great to hear.
I binged the entire thing. I did not even take a bathroom break. That's how riveted
really?
I was.
Wow. That's amazing.
That's how riveted I was. And before I dive into ninjas, I just have to tell you, since you were tied up and you couldn't come on the show for Tokyo Cowboy, I love that film.
Oh, cool. Awesome. Thank you. Yeah, that and ninjas were kind of happening at the same time. There was, I'm trying to think, it would have been the beginning of, would have been like the end of 2020 or so, but, you know, I was writing a bunch of different things and just on various jobs, and you just never know which ones are the ones that are going to go or are actually going to happen, and so at the same time, I was writing, I was writing a couple different things, and then the Tokyo Cowboy job came my way, and I wrote that with Ayako, and then House of Ninjas came my way, and it just sort of, you write them, and then you don't know what's going to happen next, and with Tokyo Cowboy, they went off and made it in Montana, and I was like, wow, cool, it's going, sweet, and then, House of Ninjas, I was originally just hired to write, write like the show Bible and the pilot, and then little by little my scope of responsibility kind of increased, and then they had me come and direct and run the show in Tokyo, and it was one of those things where you just never know where these writing assignments that you get where they're going to lead, and those two things happening at the same time were just an example of that, of just the unpredictable career of a writer/director.
I don't know if you heard it, but, Mark was on the show live, and we spent, I think, half of the time talking about you, as it should be.
Really?
As it should be. But, no, that film, Tokyo Cowboy, came out so well. He did an excellent job directing it. I wish I could have seen your directorial version, but everything about that film that captures the heart and that is so much fun and so delightful is on the, it's in the script. So your fingerprints are all over it, mister.
Oh, thanks. I can't wait. I'm going to see the final version at a film festival next month. So I'm really excited to check out the final finished Tokyo Cowboy.
No, I really like it. But now, getting back to House of Ninjas here, where did this. I know you worked with Kento and a couple other people on this one to develop and the writing. This is such a huge undertaking. It's so expansive, but it's also well plotted out. So what was your process, considering this isn't just a film, it starts, it ends, you're done. This keeps going and going, so you've really got to have an outlook as to where you want to take this. So what was your process like to develop this script, first of all?
Well, I think, whenever, because this, although at the end of the day, it ended up as something that's very, very personal in a lot of ways, and something that I feel like, is the most me thing I've ever made. This all started as an assignment. So when it came my way, it really came down to, I've got 3 weeks to come up with something. I need to write fast, And so I think that just jumping back a little ways, Kento and Murao-san and Imai-san, the three sort of guys who kind of first came up with the idea of it, they took like a project proposal to Netflix, which was basically spelled out the idea of a ninja family in modern times, and Netflix wanted to make it, but they sort of wanted a, they wanted somebody to come up with a kind of a fresh, spin on it, a little bit different take, and that's when I got the call, because one of my producers from Man from Reno, Taro Goto, had joined Netflix after that film, and so he kind of recommended me for the job, and I think that, especially when you have a very, very short time to work on something, I always try to find, a personal way into the story, and, I always loved ninjas, but I wanted to find something that was kind of, an aspect to it that hadn't been explored as much in the movies that I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
And some of my favorite ninja, stories back in the day, like the Shinobi no Mono series, are quite different from the more, action and gadget-oriented ninja movies that you see recently. So it sort of felt like there was some sort of new take to be mined from it. And when I was researching it, I just found all these just peculiar, all these rules that ninjas had, like all the dietary restrictions and all the restrictions on who you can fall in love with and serving a master, and how they were always sort of, tools in the hands of a more powerful clan. And I just really felt like, a modern day ninja family who are, living by a set of just really old values, that was sort of an interesting conflict to mine for it. And from there, it was just kind of, the other thing that I just felt really strongly about was that instead of kind of trying to have everybody sort of working in tandem all the time, I wanted each character to have their own strong, storyline, so that they were the main character in their own story. I love shows where, every episode may not, you may not be able to move the chess pieces all the way down the board, but every character is sort of, really, really, really wrapped up and engaged in their own story, and so they're each kind of moving in the darkness, not realizing that they're all sort of interconnected in one big storyline. And so that's kind of where it started from, and from there it just came down to making decisions about, what kind of challenges to give the characters, and what to what sort of obstacles to give them. And so that original Bible that I wrote, we went through a development process at Netflix, and it, got some new ideas in there, and I worked with, a team of writers in Tokyo who wrote, the remaining episodes based on my outlines, but they were really excited by the premise and kind of the world that I had come up with, and so they decided to do it, and then from there, there was a lot of exactly clear how involved I was going to be, because it really was, the original job was, the mission was to deliver this Bible, but then it became sort of a, well, maybe you could, you know, write an episode, well, maybe you could direct an episode, well, maybe you could direct, and then eventually I made it over there and got to be there from beginning to end.
Well, I'm glad you did, but I have to say, I love the characters that we have. I love how you have mixed, you've done a beautiful job of mixing the culture and history with modern day elements, such as now all of a sudden Yoko is essentially a stay-at-home mom. She's bored.
Yeah.
She wants to get her shinobi skills, keep them sharp, keep going, do something vital. You've got a dad, and I don't know how many times he says it, but every time he says it, I just laughed. When Sushi keeps saying, we're a normal family. And I love how he always stresses normal.
Yeah.
And is it? You've got the missing older brother who's dead. You've got now the second brother who is now the eldest, who he believes in peace and kindness and wants to pursue his own life, but still honor his family. You've got a daughter who's in who's college age, still mourning the loss of her older brother, but still trying to find her own footing as to where she fits in. And of course, then your scene stealer of the whole kit and caboodle is the brilliant Tentavanka as Riku. You could do a whole series just on him.
Yeah, he is so great. Just a really, really wonderful kid. You know, we auditioned a lot of kids for that role, and just as soon as he came in, everybody was like, "That's him." You know, just so he's a pretty, you know, I see him in commercials and stuff in Japan a lot, and just a really, I mean, for his age, he's a really, he has an incredibly developed talent. And, you know, he loves acting. Like, he just loves the whole process of creating the character and creating a role and everything. Just total pro. Really wonderful kid. It's funny, the very last scene that we shot with him is the opening scene of episode 2, where he's at Odawara Castle. So it was a big day with a lot of extras and everything. That was his very last scene, and he just burst into tears at the end of it.
Aww.
When everybody clapped for him, because it was such, I mean, if you think about it, we shot for more than 6 months, so for him, that's like a big chunk of his life.
Yeah.
But yeah, great kid. Can't wait to see what he does next.
But you know, then you pair him with Nobuko Miyamoto, who is Grandmother Taki, and those two are just magic together. They are magic.
Yeah, she was, I mean, that getting her in the cast was sort of a pinch me moment, and just because, you know, I love the movies that she was in, like Tampopo and Attacking Woman, and so she was just always kind of a personal hero of mine. And so, you know, and she's very, very hard to get, very selective about her roles. She doesn't, you know, there was a period of about 10 years where she wasn't in a single movie at all, fairly recently. But I wrote her a letter just telling her how, you know, I learned to speak Japanese by watching her movies. I wanted her to be in this part so bad, and she finally agreed to meet with me, and then we got her, and she is just an amazing, just total legend. I mean, everybody on the crew was sort of in awe of, you know, being able to work with her. She's just a wonderful actor.
Yeah, watching her with Tenta is just, that is pure magic. Pure magic on screen. And of course, you have so many funny moments here. I mean, the whole series, it's very fun, visually, character-wise, story-wise. But you have some out-and-out funny moments here, and so many of those come thanks to Tokio Omoto, who plays Oki.
Yeah.
He is a scream. Just
he's kind of one of a kind, you know, and he's he comes from sort of a big acting family in Japan. His brother and his dad are also famous actors, and Tokyo is just kind of, he's kind of a one of a kind talent. He's got such a, you know, you don't really have to direct him because he's, you know, he's got his thing, and he does it so well. But it's funny, he's so in demand as a character actor. I was asking him, like, so how many things are you shooting at once right now? And he was doing three things at once while we were shooting, and then, you know, he said that his record was six or seven things.
Wow. At once.
So he just goes, I'd see him on set, and he'd be studying another script because he had to be on, you know, another set the next day. Just an incredible pro. You know, the Japanese film industry, the actors tend to be sort of double and triple booked all the time, going from set to set. And then guys like, you know, folks like Tokyo, who are just so unique and just, you know, so funny and energetic and incredibly charming, they just are just crazy in demand. So scheduling is tough.
Of course, you bring in, no surprise to me, we have the cat. The cat is fabulous. It just rounds everything out. I could not imagine you not having a cat in this film.
Yeah, it seemed like, you know, it seemed like a black cat was exactly what a ninja family would have, and you know, that cat was its own scheduling sort of headache as well. There's no labor laws for humans in Japan, but for cats, you know, they have like limited work hours and stuff. So.
Oh my God. And as the husband of the mother of Cat Daddy's documentary, you have to be cognizant of cat labor laws.
Well, yeah. I have a reputation to maintain.
That's right.
You know. But no, but that cat was lovely. You know, you just sort of set it somewhere and it just kind of stays there. There was one part where we just needed it to sort of look up, and we could not get it to look at what we were trying to get it to look at. And we told the quote-unquote trainer, and he was like, don't worry, I know exactly what to do. Just roll the cameras. And then as soon as we rolled the cameras, he started blowing two whistles at once and opening and closing an umbrella, like, right off camera. And we were all just, like, jolted out of our... and then the cat just kind of, like, just sort of glanced, and that was... That was all we got. But it's in the show. So whenever the cat's on screen, just imagine a guy rapidly opening and closing an umbrella and blowing on a kazoo, and that's what the cat's reacting to nine times out of ten.
Now that you've told me that, you know that I'm going to have to go back and binge again just to see the cat.
Yeah, well, I think you'll probably start to see some of the themes in there of, you know, just lots of tricks to get that, to kind of get that cat into the show. But we had sort of a limited time to get what we wanted out of that cat. But it was a very, very sweet cat.
And he's gorgeous. And I love the idea of the black cat because he does meld with the whole shinobi ninja concept of disappearing and slinking and hiding. And this is where I'm curious about your directorial process with this one, and particularly working with your DP, Shoji Ihara, and coming up with your visual grammar and your visual tonal bandwidth, Dave, because I love how, for the most part, whenever the ninjas are in ninja form, it's typically at night, it's dark, but you have this beautiful blue-black inkiness. And when you meld the costumes with that, they disappear. There's the one scene in the one apartment. And all of a sudden, mother and kid are there, and it's like, oh my God, is that daddy? No, daddy's not home. And our ninja has disappeared into the dark. And this is consistent, and it plays almost like negative space with depth. So I'm curious about how you and Shoji came up with this visual grammar for that great effect throughout the series.
Thanks. No, I'm glad that that was sort of a multi-departmental effort in a lot of ways. So Kumiko Ogawa, who did the costume, we talked a lot about how, we wanted to kind of keep the traditional, like, you look at them and you know that you're looking at a ninja. We didn't want to try to turn ninjas into, Batman or some kind of superhero kind of thing. We wanted to keep it very utilitarian in a lot of ways. But we also wanted it to be able to have just a touch of something so that they stand out in the shadows just enough for, viewers to be able to see that they're there. Or for them to recede completely if we wanted them to, mm-hmm. And so that was a process of testing, honestly. We made prototypes of the costumes, we shot tests, and then refined from there. And then the production design it was led by Yuji Hayashida and Yasuo Takahashi. They also were kind of focused on, we always pictured the ninja house being sort of dark and old and mysterious and having a lot of kind of deep kind of wood colors and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then having the lighting sort of give everything just enough clarity so that it keeps the atmosphere without it feeling too bright, for mm-hmm. for lack of a better word. But Ibarra-san, my DP and Sugimoto-san, who did the lighting, so the two of them are these veterans from Kyoto who've been, shooting movies in Kyoto forever. So there's basically no situation that they haven't dealt with. They both are Japanese Academy Award winners and been around the block for a long time. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful people. Ibarra-san is this kind of gentlemanly, courtly, very soft-spoken, and he very much wants the director to decide on what the shots are going to be, and then he wants to execute. He basically wants to be directed. He wants to know what are the shots going to be, and then he wants to sort of add his own special sauce on top of that. Whereas, in the past, many DPs that I've worked with, it's more of a conversation together to do the shot list and kind of decide how it's going to be laid out and everything. And he is, just a wonderful in terms of his sensitivity and picking the lenses and sort of getting the, the contrast, not just in terms of contrast in the image itself, but in terms of large or small, the sizes of the shots. And, he's just really just a wonderful presence on set as well. A lot of the conversations that we had were just about trying to get this sense of normal everyday life into this show. That we didn't want to do something that felt like trying too hard. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But we wanted to sort of present, sort of a vision of, hey, this is everyday life. And then with more and more playful touches, kind of let people sink into the world and eventually get into more and more of the kind of less than ordinary, the ninja world that's hidden from everywhere else. And so I ended up picking a lot of locations that I think, at first people were a little puzzled by it. Like, why are we shooting at this ordinary, this is just so ordinary. Why would you want to shoot there? And it was, well, that's the whole idea. This is the ordinary world, and we're trying to show that this is just bubbling under the surface of everyday life. But Ibarra-san got that right away, and I think he also got the tone right away of this kind of playful but still mysterious and kind of eerie world that we were trying to create. So he, you know, so we talked a lot about how to suggest that, how to keep that playfulness, but also never lose the suspenseful edge. You know, I think that it was a great collaboration, and it was also just a wonderful filmmaking experience and education for me. This is my first time doing everything in my second language as well. Nobody on the crew, just everything was done in Japanese, and since that was the case, then that really forced me to be simple and keep my direction as clear as possible, just because, you know, there's even though I speak Japanese, I'm not a native speaker, so I was also learning, you know, a new style of filmmaking, a new style of communication on this. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the whole crew and Imada-san especially were just really lovely and patient with me.
Well, you know, something that I love that you did visually is when we get to, with no spoilers here, when there is a return of a character who appears, you've got a huge tonal shift and you're changing up your camera angles within the family house. And we now have more, there's more light. We see the window in the kitchen. Really beautiful outside. The sun is shining. Everybody's playing. Everybody's happy. It's not something we've seen before. It's kind of almost like leading into the third act. If we were just looked at this as a film, and then by the time we get to just a few episodes later with the episode 8, the eclipse, then you take us into this world, and I have to say this is gorgeous. Gorgeous. The mist, the black and white, the shades of gray, the fog, that is a stunner. And that's another big turning point as to where, metaphorically, where are we now? Things have happened. There's a shift in the zeitgeist, in the tides. And it's so beautifully structured and shot. As you lead us up to the joyous, happy, bright light within the family again, and then you bring us back to the shades of gray and what is blanketing and covering the truth. So exquisitely designed and shot, Dave. It really blew my mind.
Thanks. I got to give a shout out to, because I directed episodes 1 through 3, and then I came back for episodes 8. And then the middle episodes, I handed off the baton to Yoshiaki Murao and Tomoyuki Takimoto, who did, and Takimoto-san is the one who did the episode of the, you know, the episodes where we're kind of in the house for a little bit when mm-hmm. They get an unexpected visitor. And, you know, that was definitely part of the strategy, was to give those episodes, you know, a little bit of a different feel. Those where we're kind of sinking into some more psychological suspense. I sort of thought of it as Debbie, what's the Hitchcock movie where Joseph Cotten comes to visit his niece? It's one of my favorite movies, and the title is totally escapes me.
Oh my God! Yeah, Teresa Wright, Joseph Cotten. And I'm blanking on the title. I know it. I have it in my head. He is the twisted uncle.
I think that, you know, we start off on sort of a playful note, you know, and Takimoto-san is known in Japan for his, you know, kind of hard hitting psychological thrillers, and he felt like a great choice to kind of take the reins for, you know, when the story was kind of hitting, when the characters are kind of hitting rock bottom towards the end. And then I took the baton back for episode 8 when everything kind of comes together. And I just felt like, you know, we just had to really just really go for it in episode 8 and just not hold back and just go, you know, we've taken people on a real roller coaster ride. it takes place in these ordinary locations where the school or a brewery or a, you know, a factory or just kind of really everyday spots. And I wanted one place where we could sort of have an excuse to go into a little bit more of a fantastical realm. And since we have these enemy ninjas who have this pseudo, you know, religious aspect to them, that it made sense to me to have, you know, a ceremonial room that was kind of filled with this poisonous smoke. And then, you know, that gave us an excuse to have some fun visually and give people sort of a little bit of a more of a taste that we're getting deeper into sort of this hidden ninja world and places that we haven't seen before and into a more metaphorical space. And, you know, as that was the lighting department and the effects department spent a couple of days working on that fog, because all that fog is practical, you know, mm-hmm. when people are appearing and disappearing in it. Some of it's slightly augmented in post, but, you know, it all sort of hangs beautifully in the air, like it's painted in, because it is. You know, there's all these guys with these little handheld smokers that were sort of putting these big swirly designs in that and we'd have to redo it before every take. But they spent a couple days in the studio at Toho Studios, basically just lining all the catwalks overhead with space heaters, because they just had to get the balance of the cold air, they just basically had to get the temperature and the pressure in the mm-hmm. room just right to get the fog to hang long enough, you know, for us to get the shots off. And so that was a really, really intense, but really fun scene to shoot. And then in post, you know, I mean, by and large, we did not, you know, we were not doing crazy visual adjustments to what we shot. But that scene, you know, the colorist basically did a full black and white version of the scene and then layered it over the original color version to give it basically just that exact, you know, because it's funny, you tweak the original footage and then you lose the definition of the fog really quickly. But when we sort of, you know, overlaid the images instead, then all of a sudden, you know, the characters take on more clarity, and the fog also maintains, you can see, you know, you can sort of see the intricacy of the design of it, and you can see the fog moving with the actors as they move through it and everything, and I thought that was really cool. I can claim no credit for it. I was sort of watching and nodding along, but it was, that was a lot of fun. I was really proud of that scene.
And by the way, our Hitchcock movie neither one of us could think of is Shadow of a Doubt.
Shadow of a Doubt.
All right, Dave, I am in love with the bookend structuring of your needle drops. Your song selections are incredible. Yeah. And then Jonathan's score, you know, that fills in the gaps and throwing in some jazz is great. What were you looking for musically to really bump this up?
This is a very emotional show, but it's also, you know, content-wise, it's sort of, it has a lot of DNA of kind of the B-movie in it mm-hmm. as well. So I wanted to, you know, with the music, I wanted to signal people that we were having fun, first of all. That was one thing. But also kind of ride the line of this very, very suspenseful story that also is very poignant and, you know, in a lot of ways sad. And that was what the needle drops were about, kind of keeping that sad but fun kind of note in it. And then in terms of the score, I mean, when we were, you know, because we played everything pretty straight, but I felt like the score needed to kind of be pretty big and really a character in the show. And I drew a lot of inspiration from like great giallo scores of the 70s and 70s and 80s, and that was what a lot of the temp music was. And Jonathan Snipes is a wonderful composer. I was a big fan of his, you know, documentaries that he did with Rodney Asher. But he was also sort of a member of this band called Nilbog that covers like great giallo scores from mm-hmm. the 70s. So I knew he would understand that whole world and basically the overtly the very, very emotional I wanted a score that was just very, very emotion driven and also, you know, sort of keeps that B movie spirit alive, even though it's a very hopefully A movie execution in a lot of ways. And he's wonderful, just brilliant. My collaboration with him was just a great experience.
Well, I love the score. The needle drops, bookending it structurally with each episode, perfect. Everything about this, Dave, the entire series, I want a second season.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're doing well, and we just have to wait for them to decide if we're doing well enough to, you know, warrant more. So I hope so. I'm ready if people want it.
I want it. So there. Yeah, I want
Thanks,
it.
Debbie.
Dave, thank you. I know Mia's going to shoot me. But thank you. It's so good to talk to you again. Say hi to Mai for
Likewise.
Me.
Will do. Thanks,
All right.
Debbie.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.